Hello and welcome back to Fourth Estate, the show where journalists talk journalism. Coming to you from 2SER in Sydney on Gadigal lands of the Eora Nation, right across Australia on the Community Radio Network and directly to your device across the globe via podcast. My name's Tina Quinn. It's a pleasure, as always, to have your company. In a week where Victoria has started to loosen restrictions, as Greater Sydney finds itself going deeper and deeper into a protracted lockdown, we turn to the role that the media is playing in giving clear, unbiased information. On the weekend around the country, hordes of people protested lockdowns, charged with disinformation and paranoia. Most startling to see was in the city of Sydney, where thousands took to the streets in the middle of a lockdown with the highly contagious Delta strain on the loose. A quick look at the media coverage in the build-up will see that many corners of the media were playing up to these deranged, ill-informed and quite irresponsible views. In this edition, we ask if the media, and Sky News in particular, have gone too far and what can be done to bring not just civility but unbiased information back to the position it should hold in our public space. To help us discuss how sections of the media have let down their audiences and their country, we're joined on the mic by two mics, pardon the pun. Mike Carlton's career is extensive and packed with highlights. He began as a cadet journalist with the ABC in 1963, aged 17. He's been a foreign correspondent, a columnist, and naval historian. He was one of the original reporters on the ABC's groundbreaking current affairs program, This Day Tonight, during the 1970s, before beginning a long and successful career in radio, hosting breakfast on 2GB and highly rated drive shows on ABC 702 and then 2UE. Mike Carlton, welcome back to Fourth Estate.
Nice to be here.
And the wonderful Mike Seckham also joins us. He started his career in Queensland with the Brisbane Telegraph and then the Brisbane Daily Sun before a spell at Rupert Murdoch's The Australian. Having spent well over a decade covering politics for the Sydney Morning Herald and then 5 years overseas with the Vineyard Gazette in Massachusetts, Mike has spent the last number of years as the Saturday paper's national correspondent. Mike Seckham, welcome to Fourth Estate.
Nice to be here.
So we're 18 months into a pandemic and Sydney is now deep into a long and protracted lockdown with no end in sight. A quick look at social media will tell you we're not exactly all in this together anymore. You know, the media broke from that story as well quite a long time ago. Why do you think there is such a lack of unity? It doesn't really feel like we're a collective nation anymore. Mike Seckham, you can go first.
Look, I'm not entirely sure, to be honest. I mean, I think to some extent this has been politically engineered. I mean, there was the fact that when Victoria was in lockdown, a lot of political figures on the conservative side of politics took great delight in jumping on the Victorian government, as did certain sections of the media, particularly the Murdoch media. And I think so, to some extent, you know, we've got a bit of state of origin happening now that it's come back to bite New South Wales. So that's possibly part of it. And, you know, part of it obviously is just the fact that it's having differential impacts on different parts of the country.
Mike Carlton, what do you think?
I'd agree with that. There was a lot of sneering at Dan Andrews in the Victorian Labor government when it struck its problems. And Andrews didn't handle it perfectly by any means. Nobody did. Nobody could. They were experimenting. They were working on the fly. But the federal government in Canberra took great delight in their troubles and in raising a supercilious eyebrow. And that set the tone, I think, for political point scoring, which continues to this day. Morrison particularly was keen to laud Gladys Berejiklian, fellow New South Wales Liberal, to say what a fabulous job she'd done, the gold standard, etc. That was reflected in the media with a ludicrous magazine piece in the Australian Financial Review, Gladys Berejiklian, the woman who saved Australia. That's come back to bite a few people on the arse.
It hasn't aged line. I think it was News.com's Samantha Maiden who quipped that she's now at risk of standing accused of being the woman who basically unleashed the Delta variant on the nation, which is probably
it
more
is
fair
largely
to say.
Looking like that. Yes, yeah. I think she probably went into a lockdown too late, but I don't know. I'm not an epidemiologist or an economist.
Mike, you wrote a very interesting piece in the most recent edition of the Saturday paper, How Power and Factionalism Work in Berejiklian. You actually spoke of the way that the relationship and the different factions within the party, and that the way the Murdoch media has portrayed it is that Gladys and RPM are very close and she's his favourite premier of all the premiers and such. But you actually painted a fairly different picture to what was really going on behind the scenes. Would you like to elaborate?
Well, that's right. Berejiklian and Morrison have never been all that close, frankly, mm-hmm. despite the fact that they have the same power base in New South Wales. Berejiklian's always been very much in the moderate faction of the party. Scott Morrison has always been a bit of a chameleon in terms of factions. You know, he famously turned up at the right faction meetings and the left faction meetings. So there's that to start with. And the other thing, of course, is that circumstances have separated them somewhat, because when a state goes into lockdown, fingers of blame are inevitably pointed. And it was one thing when you had a Victorian Labor government mm-hmm. and a federal coalition government pointing the fingers at one another. But in the case of New South Wales, of course, we have two coalition governments. So, you know, when I spoke to one quite senior minister in New South Wales, you know, he was talking on background, but you would swear that you were talking to Anthony Albanese. I mean, it was the exact same lines, you know, that Scott Morrison had two jobs to do. He had to look after quarantine and he had to get the vaccine rolling out, and he blew both jobs. So it's quite hostile, I think, at the moment between the New South Wales government and the federal government, albeit that they're of the same political persuasion. And of course, you know, apart from the backgrounding that's going on to people like me, we see this in some of Berejiklian's public performances. I mean, hardly a day goes by when she does not stress the fact that we would not be in this unfortunate position in New South Wales had the rollout proceeded more smoothly. Mm. Now, you know, that's obviously a wild exaggeration, but, you know, there's a great deal of finger pointing going on between the two levels of government, and it's making it hard for both of them, I think.
I don't think Morrison actually has friends. He has allies, and he's the ultimate transactional prime minister. Exactly. In 1 month, he can be best buddies with Tony Abbott. The next month, his closest and dearest political ally is Malcolm Turnbull. He is a man who shifts with the wind. Mike Seccombe said there is a chameleon. Mm-hmm. That's pretty much right. He will go anywhere, do anything, say anything to cling on to power or the illusions of power. Berejiklian can be an ally and a friend to be lauded to the skies at 1 minute. But if she starts to get in the way, then he'll throw her overboard. I think he's the most untrustworthy prime minister we've ever had.
And I think also that his lauding of Berejiklian, you know, having the gold standard and what have you, was motivated as much by using it as a stick to beat Dan Andrews with.
Yeah,
As it was by genuine admiration for Berejiklian.
And what do you think the media's part to play in this is? Because there were various parts of the media, and I am very much talking within the factions of Murdoch and the halls of News Corp, who really jumped on that bandwagon. Mike Seccombe, you worked for The Australian a number of years ago. sorry to bring that up.
You can't blame him for that.
We're not holding it against you.
And it wasn't. And The Australian was quite a different place, I might add, back in those days. I mean, it was always conservative leaning, but, you know, it was very good on things like Indigenous issues and things mm-hmm. like that. It was not nearly the right-wing mouthpiece that it's become now.
Right.
It certainly wasn't the sort of outsourced PR unit for the coalition government.
And I know you worked for it during I know you worked for them during the Hawke and Keating governments, but they weren't afraid exactly to hold power to account regardless of who the coalition was, whether it be Malcolm Fraser or John Howard or Bob Hawke or Paul Keating.
That's absolutely true. And now I think they're terribly confused because, much like Morrison, they bashed the Victorian government mercilessly, you know, as Mike's already mentioned, you know, the dictator Dan stuff. And now when Berejiklian's in the same position, they're not adopting the same tactics.
Mm.
And furthermore, they're somewhat split. You know, they used to be very anti-lockdown. Now they've read the wind, and for the most part, they're pro-lockdown. You know, you even get people from Sky, like Andrew Clunell, who's an actual reporter with mm-hmm. Sky, unlike some of their commentators, mm-hmm. turning up at Berejiklian press conferences and demanding to know why she isn't locking down harder, which is a complete reversal of what was the situation when Victoria was in lockdown. And furthermore, not all elements of the Murdoch empire have followed suit. I mean, we still have some of the people on Sky, some of the commentators, the Andrew Bolts, the Alan Joneses of this world, mm-hmm. opposing lockdowns and being very sceptical about the benefits of vaccination. So, you know, the whole Murdoch picture is not looking nearly as monolithic as it usually does.
Well, touching on Alan Jones, so and I guess Sky News, I mean, they've been going to some pretty dark spaces in recent months. Alan Jones in particular has been waging a war on multiple fronts, from vaccine disinformation to vitriolic attacks on the premiers and basically all health experts. He's called Dr. Chant a village idiot, for instance. Okay, so here's a bit of a Dorothy Dixer for you both. Do you think he's gone too far? Mike Carlton, to you first.
Gone too far for the Daily Telegraph because they sacked him today.
Yes.
His column will no longer appear. Now, it's a singular achievement to be sacked by the Daily Telegraph for being a right-wing lunatic. It's grabbing the column star. And the word around the traps is that he has not much longer to last at Sky either. His contract has another couple of months to run, I think.
Right.
He'll probably get punted from there too. But there seems to be a bit of a shift going on at News Limited. I suffer at a bit of a disadvantage here because I'm an old-age pensioner and life is too short now to read the News Limited papers day by day. But you get the picture.
Mm.
Mike Secker made the point there that they're the PR mouthpiece for the government. I tend to think of it in reverse, that the government is actually the political wing of the Murdochracy.
Well, the official reason for his being let go today was that, you know, his anti-lockdown and anti-vaccination columns aren't really resonating with the telly's audience. But do you think the telly's actually smelling the tea leaves as such, or is there a major reversal happening at News Limited over its recent coverage?
Who knows? Who knows the occult processes they indulge in over there? But it does seem that the telly is now backing a vaccination campaign, while Jones has been, you know, saying that the whole thing is a farce and a fraud and a fake and that we're all being conned. I suspect he just no longer was willing to go along with their suddenly reversed editorial line. Let us all remember, I think, this is quite important, that Rupert Murdoch was about the first person in the world to get the vaccine.
Right. That's probably not a bad point. Not a bad point. Look, I don't know if any of you ever have a look at the Batuta, but, you know, they were very quick to point out, you know, here's this man speaking out against vaccinations and lockdowns, but he made Sky News basically build a studio for him at home so he could broadcast from home. So he's, you know, high up above in his tower. He doesn't need to leave his home. He's keeping fairly safe, yet he's blasting the need for lockdowns and, you know, dispelling the notion that we all need to get vaccinated.
Yeah, I get most of my news from the Batuta Advocate and from Sean McAuliffe, actually. I find them very accurate and dispassionate. And, of course, the Saturday paper, Mr. Seckham's excellent out for it.
Absolutely, absolutely.
Thank you.
Staying on Sky News, they have been routinely attacking and undermining lockdowns over quite a protracted period of time when, as we know, it's the only proven way to reduce transmission minus mass vaccinations. Corey Bernardi, for instance, on his Sky program has been referring to people being forced to have experimental vaccines and the service by and large has been beating up stories about vaccine passports as some kind of government overreach or even something far, far darker, like, you know, the Great Reset or something. At what point does Sky News cross the line from being a news service with a successful business model into being a media outlet that is basically just a danger to the public? Mike Secombe, to you?
Well, on this particular subject, I think it is a danger to the public. I mean, I think the same on climate change, my dad. I mean, Sky News has been set up essentially to be something akin to what Fox is in America. And I think it's kind of heartening in a way that whereas Fox has been broadcasting this kind of disinformation about the virus and the vaccines, and people have been swallowing it in large numbers, all the Trumpies fall upon it eagerly, it doesn't seem to have resonated as much in the Australian community. And I think that that's something of a feather in our national cap, quite frankly.
Mm-hmm. Sky News' audience tends to be older, and with that they probably have access to a more narrow group of media portals. Seeing we're about to hit August and still 25% of people over 70 are not vaccinated at all, and with that Sky News is still spreading disinformation, and we talk about experimental vaccines, have we passed the point of not just calling this out but needing to ask for action and sanctions against Sky News? Mike Carlton?
I don't think you can lay all that at the door of Sky News. Some of it, perhaps, yes. But the rollout of the vaccine was abominably handled. The seeds of doubt were sown about AstraZeneca months ago when it was suitable for people over 70, then over 60, then perhaps, well, if you asked your doctor, you could have it if you were 40. There was utter and total confusion about that, which you lay at the door, not of Sky News, but of the door of Morrison and that stupid health minister of his, Hunt. They totally botched the rollout. They engendered no confidence, no enthusiasm. They raised grave doubts in the minds of many elderly folk and their families. And that's the reason I think that still many older people are not done. Add to that the absolute shambles of failure of any sort of rollout in aged care institutions, which is the total responsibility of the federal government. And that's why you have the situation we find ourselves in today, I think. Sky News, part of it, yes, but only a minor part in that sense.
Mike Seckham, you were talking about Sky was set up basically to be, you know, Australia's version of Fox. Disinformation in right-wing cable news space relies on, you know, basically a smoke and mirror trick with presenting people as experts who, you know, just simply aren't experts. You know, in the case of Alan Jones, he's been using Craig Kelly. This kind of practice, it's not unique to just Sky's COVID coverage. Mike, you mentioned the climate coverage being another issue which comes to mind, where the actual experts are not just avoided, but they're attacked. Do you think it's time the media had greater restriction about misleading its audience? Because, you know, clearly where Craig Kelly is presented as an expert on COVID-19, the system hasn't just failed us, it's really fallen to pieces.
Well, I do think so. I'm always troubled by the idea of closing down people's opinions and, you know, cancelling them, essentially. I really think the best you can do is just call them out for the idiots they are and mm-hmm. hope that ultimately people go with the expertise. But this is a troubling aspect of the whole right-wing media landscape, you know, social media and mainstream media as well, which is underlying all of this is a fundamental distrust of expertise. It's almost like the fact that you're an expert in a subject, that makes you immediately subject to suspicion.
Mm.
I just don't know quite what you can do about that. It's sort of a very proud anti-intellectualism that I find deeply troubling.
Mike Carlton?
Added to which, in Jones's case, you can add misogyny as well. His his record of loathing women in authority is there for all to see. I mean, it goes back generations, well before Julia Gillard and so on. He does not like women in power. Hence his jihad now upon Gladys Berejiklian, and that appalling attack, those constant appalling attacks on the New South Wales Chief Health Officer, Kerry Chan, and calling him the village idiot and so on. So add to that, that's sort of another layer over the anti-intellectualism that Mike was talking about.
Mike Carlton, Alan Jones, you know, and I hope you don't mind me mentioning, an old rival of yours, basically. I think you once went head-to-head with him when you were at 2GB and he was 2UE. I'm guessing you knew Alan fairly well amongst the...
Not in the biblical sense, no.
I wasn't getting at that.
I would hope not.
No judge. I mean, not that there's anything wrong with that, to quote Jerry Seinfeld, but I'm sure you knew him fairly well around the trappings, around, you know, the broadcast trappings.
Yeah,
What did you make of him in those early days?
We had adjoining offices there for a while.
Right.
I always thought he was a trumped-up little martinet of no particular insight or value.
Right.
He bullied his staff. There was no intellectual underpinning. He used to try and have it thought that he'd been to Oxford and was an Oxford graduate, etc. Well, he had been, but he did this, I think, a 9-month teacher's training scholarship there and so on. I thought he was an odious creature in every sense of the word. He was not a journalist. He had no rigor about accuracy. And simply existed for his own self-aggrandizement.
But what did you really think?
Yeah. Apart from that, lovely fellow.
Oh dear. Okay. Well.
But it is largely ridiculous, isn't it? Here is a multimillionaire with a beautiful farming property in Sydney's Southern Highlands, an elegant apartment on Sydney Harbour overlooking the Harbour Bridge. Chauffeured here and there in a Mercedes-Benz and posturing as the voice of the little people. I mean, this is bizarre.
Mm-hmm. Well, I don't think it would be the first time that turkeys have ever, you know, really cheered for Christmas, right?
Yeah, no.
Certainly not in this country. Do you think Sydney getting into a deeper hole over the Delta strain has broken a simple partisan story that had taken hold, that, you know, Victoria messed it up and Sydney was the gold standard. Is the lesson here, do you think, for the media and our pollies to keep politics out of reporting on what is a health problem? It's a health crisis. Mike Seckham?
I couldn't agree with you more. It was very unwise to rush to judgment when Victoria was, no doubt they made their mistakes, but they were going through the motions of learning how to cope, and people were far too critical too early. And to her credit, I don't think Berejiklian was one of them. I mean, it was more other people in the federal coalition. I mean, Morrison for one, Josh Frydenberg in particular was just hysterical about it.
Mm.
Berejiklian, and I made this point in my story, Berejiklian herself never claimed to have the gold standard.
Mm-hmm.
And although she came into some inevitable conflict with some of the other premiers about lockdowns and things, you know, particularly with Queensland, I don't think she sought to politicise it in quite the same way as others did.
Mm-hmm.
And I think maybe that's part of the reason that in spite of the fact that she clearly locked down too late, she possibly hasn't suffered as much in public terms of public esteem as she might otherwise have done. The initial claim, you know, by Morrison and others was we're all in this together. And then they immediately started undermining this notion that we're all in it together by getting stuck into one another. It would have been nice, I think, if we had all just learned the lessons from one another and accepted that people were doing their best.
It's instructive here, I think, that the New South Wales Labor opposition has behaved itself impeccably. They are simply supporting Berejiklian. They're offering very, very little criticism, the occasional constructive suggestion. Compare that to that shambling bunch of trolls and halfwits which infest the Victorian opposition benches, the Liberals down there, who are a disgrace. And they played a great role, a great part in politicising the response down there in Victoria. Morrison and, as Mike said, Frydenberg had a large part in that too. They were anxious to prove that the Victorian Labor government was hopelessly incompetent. And that undermined public confidence.
I think also here there's an ideological incompetence that we've seen, which is there's a neoliberal belief that we had to put the economy first and that keeping, and this was, you know, we saw this widely among the sort of economic commentators in the Fin Review and the Australian and such like, that, you know, we should keep things open at all costs for the sake of business. And what has been shown is that you have to look after the health aspect of it first, and that will actually achieve a better economic outcome as well. You know, if you control the virus, you keep the economy running. Mm. They looked at it, I think, the wrong way around. And that's now plain for all to see.
Mm. You're listening to For the State, and our guests are Mike Seckham and Mike Carlton. The media is largely self-regulated, and of course, government involvement in the Fourth Estate is something we should want to avoid. But do you think, is it fair to say that self-regulation has failed the industry, and that the Australian and basically the Australian people in this case? Mike Carlton, to you?
I'm always wary about bringing in laws and rules and regulations to sort of load on top of the media. It can be dangerous. But there is also an argument that in the broadcast media, that television and radio, that there should be stricter controls. ACMA, whatever it's called these days, I don't know, the Broadcasting Regulation Authority, is a toothless tiger. It's a chihuahua. It can enforce nothing. Yet if patently false and untrue statements, outright lies are broadcast, ACMA should have the power to order and to force an apology and a correction. They don't at the moment. They have only a slap on the wrist available to them. That's all they can do. As for newspapers, I think there should be some redress where incorrect information, where lies and falsehoods have been published. There should also be some, I think, mechanism for retracting that, for apologising and withdrawing. I don't know how you'd do it. As I say, I'm quite wary about that, but there is a case for it. Not for opinion. I mean, opinion's something else, and you've got to let that run free. But we're factual. Mm. Well, what should be a factual news report is actually shot through with error and propaganda. I think there's a case for doing something about that. I don't know. What do you think, Mike?
Well, I sort of agree with you, but as you said, the logistics of it are very hard. I mean, you know, as the old saying goes, everyone's entitled to their own opinion. No one's entitled to their own facts, you know. But it's become increasingly different to separate the two out.
Well, the opinion columnists seem to be driving a lot of the disinformation that we're seeing at present. So that in itself, everybody is entitled to an opinion, but the problem is that some people, some of the population are taking these opinions as fact.
Yeah, that's right. But once again, you know, who determines the line between opinion and fact? That's the hard thing. What body do you take it to the courts? You know, we mentioned ACMA. It's just a very, very difficult needle to thread, I think.
The Press Council has received a lot of criticism lately. Its adjudications have taken way too long to even be relevant anymore, and it's also seen by many as being just a bit too timid. Do you think, is it salvageable, or do we need to look for a new model? And if so, what might that look like? Mike Seckham?
I don't really feel competent to venture an opinion on a potential new model, although I agree the council as it currently exists it's like being, you know, beaten with a wet lettuce to have an adjudication against you. And a lot of media, you know, either reported in a very minor way that there's been an adjudication or they just ignore it. It doesn't seem to me to have any consequence at all.
Mm. Mr. Carlton?
I'm not competent either to say what should be done. I think something must be done, but God knows what. I understand. I just bring this, pluck this out of thin air. I think the Canadians have some stronger form of redress for error in both print and the broadcast media, but I'm not sure what it is. That's not very helpful, I know, but there must be ways of improving the situation we have now.
Okay, well, we've been putting the blowtorch on the media in this edition of Fourth Estate and its coverage of the pandemic. Let's end on a positive note. For each of you, what has the media got right, and which sections are, do you think, leading by example? Are there standout stories or are there standout journos? To you, Mr. Carlton, first.
Lord, that's very hard. I'm at the point of exhaustion of the whole thing, to be brutally honest. I wake up each morning, reach for the iPad and flip through the news the news apps, and it's all COVID, COVID, COVID. Mm. There's a new epidemiologist every day. There's a new journalistic take every day. I'm actually weary of it. I'm exhausted by it. And I'm a journalist. I read for a living. What the average person, the average consumer, the average punter thinks, I don't know, but I suspect many people have switched off. I can't see anybody who has come out head and shoulders as a shining exemplar of journalistic perfection. No.
Present company excluded, of course.
Yeah, well, absolutely.
Does it make you want to... Mike Carlton, you retired from radio over 10 years ago. Does it ever make you want to get back into the game?
No. I mean, I used to be a Boy Scout once, but I have no desire to return to that either. those days are gone. I'm happily writing a book of naval history at the moment. It's sane. I'm going back to the relatively peaceful and sanguine times of 1941. Things were much better then.
when we had a world war raging, basically.
Yes. It was relatively simple. You know?
But you still consider yourself a journalist?
Yeah, I guess I am. Born, raised, and bred, and all that sort of stuff. Yes, yep. And proud to have been one. Although I rather quail and shrink from some of the wretched excesses of the trade these days.
Right, Mr. Seckham, what about yourself? Any standout stories or journos, or do you see any sections of the media that are really leading by example throughout all of this chaos?
I don't know about sections of the media per se. First of all, I would say, you know, ignore the Murdoch tabloids. Ignore the shock jocks by and large.
Mm-hmm.
Ignore Sky News. That said, you know, I would have to go to individuals. I mean, I love Ross Gittins in the Sydney Morning Herald. I love Laura Tingle on the ABC, who's just very sharp. Lenore Taylor, Catherine Murphy. In fact, most of the people that I seem to admire these days are women reporters, women commentators.
Mm.
And, you know, of course, if we were to look internationally, you know, I love various people in the New York Times and what have you.
Mm-hmm.
But, you know, basically, you know, your ABC, what used to be Fairfax, The Guardian, the Saturday paper, dare I say, you know, the people who actually take it seriously, who don't take a tabloid approach,
mm-hmm.
who, even when they reach opinions, do it on the basis of accepted fact. You know, those are the people you have to look to and the people you have to admire.
Well said. On that note, I'd like to thank both of our guests this week. Mike Carlton, thanks for joining us again on Fourth Estate.
Thank you. It was a pleasure. I enjoyed it.
And Mike Seckham, thank you for being on Fourth Estate as well.
It was a lot of fun. Thanks.
And thank you for listening to Fourth Estate. This edition was recorded at the studios of 2SER and heard across the country on the Community Radio Network. Fourth Estate is produced with the assistance of the Community Broadcasting Foundation. Many thanks to the Foundation for their continuing support. Make sure you subscribe to Fourth Estate on your favourite podcast app so you can hear us talk media, politics and a lot in between. We'll be back with more next week, of course, but in the meantime, you can stay in touch with us on Twitter. Our handle is Fourth Estate AU. A big thanks, as always, to my executive producer, Anthony Dockrell. My name's Tina Quinn. Please do stay well, and you can catch us next week on Fourth Estate.